What are your qualifications?
Well, I attended Juilliard. I'm a graduate of the Harvard Business School. I travel quite extensively.
I have people skills. I am good at dealing with people.
You just don't know when to give up, do you?
I could do this all day.
The Matt Sodnikar Podcast.
Tech episodes of this podcast are now supported by Furos.io. That is Furos.io. Furos is a Denver cloud consulting firm, and chances are if there's a big building in downtown Denver with their logo on the outside of it, Furos has got people in there doing some very interesting work that has an impact on those businesses. They focus on AWS, cloud, consulting, and their mantra is simple. Hire the best people they can, pay them really well, and let them work on challenging, interesting projects that have impacts on the business. So if you are struggling with the cloud, and I know that's a really overused word in the tech space, and projects aren't getting done, and you need some help, look them up, furos.io. That is F-U-R-O-S.io. All right, welcome to the podcast. This is Matt Sodnikar. I'm sitting here with my new friend, Sean Carney. He is an entrepreneur, and he is focused on technology and the implications on human performance. And with that, Sean, welcome, and thanks for making the time.
Yeah, thanks, Matt. It's great to be here.
Yeah, appreciate it. Something you had said right when before we started recording was that you consider yourself lucky.
Yeah.
And in finding work. And I thought that was, I wanted to kind of get your definition of lucky and then what the impact was and how that has impacted your life, and then come back to the technology side of that.
Yeah, I think it's a really important question, because I've been in the personal and professional development realm for most of my life. And I really try to study, what is it that makes people successful? You know, where does that really come from? And same thing with my own life, because, you know, while I've studied a lot of techniques, a lot of methodologies, I've taught a lot of those, you know, all around the world, which has been really amazing. When I step back and think about it, I'm like, where do these opportunities come from? And where do they come from for me? Just so I can, that's where I'm closest and hopefully have the best awareness as much as I can try. And what I've realized is, like, every major opportunity that I've had, I haven't really deserved it. You know, I don't really feel like I earned it. I was given it in advance of somebody who gave me some level of trust. And a lot of times I would think to myself, especially early, but it still happens to me all the time now, where I think, God, like, where is this coming from? Like, why am I getting this opportunity? Because I don't necessarily always feel like I can even do it. But in some cases, I'm like, well, this person, I respect them. I trust them. They must see something, you know, where they're willing to at least give me a shot at this. I am trying to do the best I can to be transparent about, I don't necessarily know what I'm doing. And I think at the same time, when I look back over my career and I've worked with other leaders, that's a recurring theme. There's this idea of the imposter syndrome. Have you heard of that?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
I'm living it.
Are you? Yeah. Well, you have a good good company. Because a lot of people, I think anybody who's doing something new, if they're not a sociopath, you know, they recognize at least at some level that, of course, they don't know what they're doing because they haven't done it before. Maybe nobody's done it before. And where does that confidence come from? Like the gall to think, okay, Matt, like, why do you think you can do this thing you haven't done? You have no evidence for it.
Right.
But at the same time, like, if you don't have it, especially if you're leading teams of other people, you could be up there and say, look, I don't know what I'm doing. And yeah, that will take some of the pressure off of you. And at the same time, your responsibility as someone who's a leader or a coach or someone who's trying to help other people is to say, I don't know what we're going to do. I just know we're going to figure it out. And I do have at least some ideas of where to start, and hopefully I've gotten them from other people who maybe done something in parallel if they haven't done exactly that same thing. But I think the thing about being a leader is that you're saying, by definition, we're going in this direction. Whereas a manager, you're saying, well, look, I already know where we're going. I'm just going to help you get there every time and do it maybe as efficiently as possible and reduce cost and, you know, all that kind of stuff. But leadership and entrepreneurship or just, you know, experimentation are all about, I've got to figure out a way to trust myself and also maybe trust other people that they can do stuff that they haven't done before. And that on some level is just amazing to me, you know, when that happens over and over and over again. And when I was a kid and I had mentors that would do that, I would think, man, like, I'll never be able to pay them back for what they gave me. I'll try to pay it forward by trying to, you know, give the same opportunities as much as I can to other people. But at the same time, I mean, there is a luck of being in the right place at the right time and having people say yes to you when maybe you'd say no to yourself normally.
Mm-hmm.
That was a long answer.
Oh, I loved it. Yeah, I loved it. I want to go back to when you use the word deserved, and I don't usually like dive into semantics, but when you were describing that, did you use deserved in the context that it was unworthy or that you didn't have the skill set at that point?
Well, I mean, I think self-worth or worth in terms of any human being is an interesting philosophical conversation.
Yeah.
There's certainly been a lot written on it. And I'm not totally sure I have an opinion on that because, and I try to have an opinion on everything just like everybody does. And at the same time, I think, well, worth and compared to what? Like, If we're talking money and transaction, we agree that this is worth something, and that's kind of the basis for us to have an economy. But when it comes to like what we're talking about, opportunities and giving each other some level of trust and belief in somebody's ability, I don't know that worth is the right way to think about it.
Yeah, I didn't get a sense that there was any sort of not self-deprecation, something stronger than that, that you were beating yourself up, that, you know, because I think there's a very fine line between not knowing exactly what's going to happen, but I can pattern match and I've figured out something similar. Mm-hmm. That's, you know, part of that. But I didn't get any sense of like unworthiness in that. You know, it was more, I was just trying to clarify, I think, from my own understanding that there was like a degree of humility, but also confidence in there. And I was just curious about the word choice. But
yeah, I mean, we both have kids. Oops, sorry.
That's right.
I mean, we both have kids that are in that 17 to 22 range.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, hopefully we want to be good examples to them. And, you know, in addition to being good providers and everything else, but you know, there are definitely lessons that we've learned over time that we think, God, if I could go back and talk to myself at that age, I wish I could tell them, you know what, you know, don't be so hard on yourself. Have, you know, a little bit more faith in the people around you. Surround yourself with people who are really going to believe in you and support you. And, you know, all those kinds of simple life's lessons that are so important. And at the same time is, you know, both my kids, you know, there are times where they will say, well, I'm not sure that I'm going to do this because I'm not sure that I'm the right person to do it. I'm like, you're 20 years old or 22 years old. Like, you're not sure about anything. That's great. You know,
yeah.
And it's okay. It's okay if you try it and it doesn't work, or you try it and you just don't like it, or it's not the right timing. It's at the same time to think, well, I haven't really earned it. It's like, well, you may never earn it, right? I mean, it's not about earning, because then it makes it like a transaction. Like, I did it and now I get to enjoy it. It's like, just enjoy it and try to create other opportunities for other people, because I don't know that I'll, like, one of my early mentors, this guy Bruce Lipton, who's a cellular biologist, he travels all around the world now, he's written books, and he's an amazing guy. And when I met him when I was in college, every time I would talk to that guy, I'd think, I can't believe that this guy talks to me. Like, I can't believe he gives me the time of day. much less, you know, when we became friends and we would hang out and stuff, every single time I would think, like, how in the world did I get here? Like, I'm never going to be at this guy's level. But I'm going to still enjoy it. So, I mean, if he says come over, I'm going over.
Right.
I'm not going to say, well, I don't deserve it, because I definitely don't deserve it. Like, I haven't done anything to earn it. There's nothing I'm going to give him that's the same level of value of what he's given me. Like, and that's not the goal. Like, I shouldn't be trying to pay him back. I should be trying to take what he's given me and do something with it.
And I think if you're around the right people, when I say right, I'm thinking shared values, they wouldn't be looking for that either. Like, they see something in you or me that aligns with their values, or they're a great person. And I almost think that it's offensive to either them or to that, like, unspoken contract to sort of question why you're being asked. It's like, yeah, you're being invited, go.
Yeah.
I live for those moments, and I, you know, I'm in the right time. It's not the right place necessarily, but I'm in the right time. And when all that happens and it kind of slows down and everything is being just addressed in terms of, you know, I don't know if it's the hierarchy of needs, but it's kind of like you're just resonating on so many levels. It's like when that happens, it's so rare and so amazing. And it's like you just walk out and like the next 5-6 hours, the next day, you're like, man, I'm exactly when and where I'm supposed to be.
Yeah.
And all the hard work has been done previously. Like, when it feels easy, mm-hmm, I think you've suffered long ago. Then you've taken enough swings in the batting cage or at the driving range, and you're like, oh, okay. I've paid for this already.
Yeah. And I think, you know, based on, you know, the little time that we've known each other, a lot of people would look at you and think, oh, here's a guy who's got his shit together. You know, he's super smart. You know, he seems to be, you know, confident and relatively at ease. And I don't think what a lot of people would know is, like, you work hard. Like, I mean, that's one thing I know just from the limited amount of time that we've, you know, known each other. You work really hard. And that's amazing. Like, that's inspiring to me. To say, okay, that, and because that makes it more accessible. It makes it, it's not just Matt is just this amazing guy, which you are. It's that, okay, maybe I can be a little bit like that guy. You know, maybe if I, you know, if I make some adjustments on what I'm doing, then I can get some of the same kinds of results of what he's doing. That's why, like, when I was a kid, my superhero, you know, favorite superheroes were, like, you know, Doctor Strange or Iron Man, because, yeah, they weren't the product of some random, you know, radioactive experiment gone wrong. They worked, you know, they got to where they were by just working really hard. I'm like, okay, I can relate to that. I probably am not going to get bit by a radioactive spider, but I can work hard. I mean, at least I can do that.
Thank you for the compliment. That means a lot. And to hear it phrased that way at this point in my life is probably the, just so you know, one of the highest compliments I would want someone to say. And, you know, you talked about professional development, and I thought when I left college, like, I was done with books and learning, yeah, and all that, and realized, hopefully not too late, but whenever you figure it out, you figure it out, is that if someone else can learn a skill, I could learn it too. And the fact that you recognize the hard work, that really means a lot.
Yeah, my pleasure.
Yeah. I'll be journaling about that tonight. Just that, I mean, that's, and conversely, like, when somebody, like, on the bike, when somebody goes, oh, it's easy for you.
Yeah.
Because I'm faster than they are.
Right.
It really offends me. It's like, fuck you. You don't see me riding at 5:30 in the morning.
Yeah.
In January, bored out of my mind on a trainer or suffering out in the cold. Like, it's easy for me. Mm-hmm. You're seeing the highlight reel.
Yeah.
So again, that really means a lot. And,
Yeah, I totally relate to that, you know, and I mean, we're almost like brothers in some ways. We have so much in common. It's kind of scary. And, you know, so we're both guitar players. And, you know, I like to perform. That's the reason why I started playing guitar. I learned guitar because I wanted to meet girls. Like, I mean, that was my motivation. And I picked a guitar because I could take it anywhere. Whereas, you know, I'd love to play keyboard, but it's hard to take on a beach. Right.
Right.
But,
and you're not going to be one of the keyboard, you know, strap 80s guys because, like, nobody's paying attention to that dude.
Very few people can make that look cool.
Keanu Reeves couldn't pull that off.
No, I just wanted to look cool as I could be. And I love playing and I love performing and it's really, really fun. And invariably, whenever we play, because my partner Ed and I, you know, we've played together for years and we will almost always have somebody come up at some point and say, man, you know, I really wish I could play guitar. And we're like, just learn. And they're like, well, I don't have any talent. I'm like, it's not talent. It's practice. That's all it is. It's like, no, I don't have any. I'm like, do you think Jimi Hendrix like popped out of the womb and started playing Star Spangled Banner? Like, you're out of your mind. It's just practice. And it's accessible to you. You just need to make the commitment and don't sell yourself short that you don't have ability. Like, the ability comes from practice. And if you could, it's amazing how much you can learn in a really short period of time. You put in 100 hours, that doesn't seem like a lot. But 100 hours will take you from being, you can't do it, to you're actually really good at almost anything. And it seems like, is that possible? It's like, yeah. Because that's 100 hours more than most people have put into it. And you can go far. And if you've got a good mentor and you've got a good example and you can do really deliberate practice, which is, there's a lot of, you know, research on that now too, where it's focused and it's serious. You're not just noodling or messing around, which is fun. You know, I like to do that too. But if you put in the effort of, I'm going to push myself, and you can push yourself for 100 hours, you could be really good. You could be better than people have been doing it for years.
Yeah. Well, and we had a whole conversation before we started recording about ADD.
Yeah.
And you talk about the hours and the practice. And I have become aware or coached myself that when it starts getting boring, I'm just about to make some sort of leap to a next level. And I have to be humble in that moment and just recognize, like, okay, I've got enough practice behind me that this is looking repetitive, and I'm just now to the point where I've climbed to base camp one. Mm-hmm. And now the real climb starts. So it's like, if I start getting bored, I'm like, okay, time to do whatever to manage the attention and like go right back to it.
Yeah. I think that's so cool. And so we were talking about doing even like keyboard or electronic music too. And I have, you know, somewhat debates with people occasionally about whether that's even really music, you know, especially with some of the apps that you can download now, because there's amazing, amazing apps that can make you sound good. Like we were talking about, you know, my keyboard skills are terrible, but I can hit three keys, a current chord. And I've figured out ways to make, you know, with synthesizer type of applications, it sounds cool. Like, there's all kinds of things that you can do to cheat. And I'm totally fine with that. And I'm totally good with other people doing it. So if I have somebody who says, I don't have any musical bone in my body, I'm like, try this thing. Like, because they can go from, wow, like, that sounds cool. Like, they don't have no skill. But the app will at least encourage them to think, maybe I could get it. Like, if I can get somebody from, I can't do it, to maybe I can do it, that's a big step. Because that maybe I can might lead to, I will, and I'll actually try.
Yeah.
And that could be a magic moment for somebody. I think almost all the big moments of people's lives are going from, I can't do something, to maybe I can.
That's all you need, is the little tender spark of belief that maybe it's possible.
Yeah.
I had a really good guitar teacher. I still kind of do. It's been years since I've taken one, but he was giving me some of the behind the scenes tips and tricks. And he showed me the intro to Iron Man with Tony Iommi.
Oh yeah, man.
And how he went past the frets and he's on the other side where the strings go into the wind or whatever that's called.
Yeah.
And he pressed on that side to make that Iron Man sound. And I just looked at that and I was like, how many people have had a guitar and never went like the other way and were just kind of screwing around with that, whether it was by accident or he was experimenting? And that blew me away that he just figured that out.
Yeah.
And I was like, wow.
Yeah. And there's so much, like, we could talk about music for hours. You know, I was a big Pink Floyd fan. That was my thing when I was in high school.
I've grown to appreciate him now. I didn't like him in high school.
Yeah, I was like, that was it for me, man. Like, I was so deep into that people I didn't even know would ask me Pink Floyd, you know, questions, which is really strange in hindsight. But it was fun. And for me, particularly that group, was not known for a visual presence. Like most, I mean, they would make fun of it, actually, you know, which one's Pink?
Yeah.
You know, okay. But most people wouldn't know them if they saw them on the street. They're not like Ozzy Osbourne or, you know, Bono or something. They're gods, right? So for me, like learning how to play guitar, like I didn't even want to try to learn any Pink Floyd because I just thought, well, that's just not possible for a mere mortal like me. But when you learn a little bit and you're like, wow, like I can actually, I'm not going to be David Gilmour, but I can actually play a little bit of that. Then you think, maybe I can actually learn the whole thing. And then once you learn a few of those songs, you think, man, like it's not something that's inaccessible. And you know, speaking of Iron Man, my oldest son, when I think he was 9 and he was taking guitar lessons, he got to do a recital, and he would probably kill me for talking about this on a podcast, but you know, he was relatively shy, so I was like thrilled that he was going to perform because I love performing. And that was the song he did, Iron Man. And not only did he do it, but he blew out the speakers.
Yes. I'm so like, metal.
I'm so proud. He just sat there until, you know, the people running the sound got it to come back on, and he picked up exactly where he left off. And I'm like, that was so cool. Like,
proudest moment as a father, just having like, a credit card, whatever it cost, that was worth it, man.
I was so happy. Yeah.
Is there a song that you know of from any band, Pink Floyd, that you wish you had written?
No. I mean, I write my own songs.
Okay.
And part of the reason I started writing songs is because I couldn't play other people's songs. And especially I like to sing, but I'm not a great singer. Like, so I can't really, you know, sing other people's songs particularly well. So if I write my own song and sing it and someone says, you know, I don't like that, I can say, well, that's how it's supposed to sound though, because that's what it was written to do. So the fact, I mean, I don't care who it is. That's another good lesson of, you know, people's limitations in terms of thinking. Is I would sometimes ask people, like, think of your favorite, you know, band or your favorite song, and realize most people in the world have never heard of them, or they've never heard that thing. Most people. Now, most people you know probably have, because we tend to be around people like us. But the majority of people have never heard that. And the majority of people who have don't like it. So, I'll say somebody like U2, one of the biggest bands in the world. There are people who hate them. Like, they hate them. And I'm like, wow. And most people are indifferent. You know, there's fans, but it's a very small percentage of people who even know that they exist. And that's true for everything. So, when I would work with, you know, for example, other artists or other consultants or whatever, who are like, well, I've got to make my mark and I have to do everything completely my own. I'm like, that's great. At the same time, it doesn't mean that you have to compete. right? Like I worked with art galleries years ago and I went all over Denver. We had this, big electronics company who was trying to build, these boutique, little pop-up stores, and they wanted to kind of, tie into the art community. So they paid us to essentially go talk to everybody in Denver who had a studio, who had a museum, who had, a gallery, anything. So we did talk to everybody, from the Denver Art Museum to all these little galleries and bars that played music and studios and everything. And I was just amazed how many of them were going broke, number one. And number two, when I would ask them, like, what are you doing to try to get more people in here so you can actually survive? They didn't want to do anything different than what they were doing because they thought, this is my niche. This is who I am. It's like, but your niche sucks. Like, people don't like it. I feel bad because I don't like it. And I'm like, who the fuck am I to judge you? But, like, I can't help it. Like, we all have reactions to things. And I was trying to think, like, I would go to a studio and they'd say, this thing is, holds 200 or 300 people and it's only being used one day out of the month. And I'd be like, okay, like, what would it take to bring more people in? It's like, we thought about, showing some films here. I'm like, so what do you need to show films? It's like, well, we need like a good high quality projector. I'm like, okay, well, they're too expensive. So I go to another place. And they'd say, what we need is a place where we can host these events because we've outgrown this space. And I'm like, oh, well, like, what do you have, that's unique? They said, well, we have this amazing projector. I'm like, oh, I'm so excited. Like, have you met these other people? Because, if you brought your projector over there, and let them borrow it, they could do their events and you could do your events at their space. And they're like, oh no, they're like our competition. I'm like, what do you mean your competition? It's like, yeah, it's like we don't work with them. I'm like, you're insane. Like, I don't get it. Like, people don't go to a museum every day, right? So it's not like, and if they like it, they probably go to more than one. That'd be like saying, I don't know, I'd be like saying, I like Beyonce, so that's all I'm going to buy? Like, I only like Beyonce music? No, if you like that kind of music, you probably like a lot of other stuff, and you're probably listening to a lot of other artists. So the fact that you're saying, well, it's either Beyonce or nothing, that's just, or like, you either come to my gallery, or you don't go to anybody else, like you're crazy. Like, people who like your stuff probably like that kind of thing. And they're going to other places. Why can't you put your ego aside for a minute and say, I could collaborate and do much better. Maybe I could learn something from them. Maybe I could help them. Like, what's wrong with helping people or getting help?
Do you think it's ego? Like, when you were talking about the projector place and the gallery space, do you think it's ego, or what causes them to initially discard that idea?
Yeah, I don't think it's just ego, like in the I'm better than you kind of perspective. I think it's almost exactly the opposite a lot of times, which is I'm afraid is what it really is.
Oh.
Like, I'm afraid that if I stand next to you, people are going to talk to, they're only going to talk to Matt and they're not going to talk to me. Like, so if I just keep my distance, I don't have to deal with that. but if I go to his party and like everybody's talking to Matt, I'm like, man, now I feel I gotta look at myself and say, what the hell? Like, why is everybody avoiding me?
It's like a preemptive breakup.
Yeah, like I'd rather just say, fuck Matt, go talk to that guy. He's an asshole. But it's not because I really believe I'm better. It's just I'm afraid that I'm worse.
Yeah.
And that's the easiest way for me to avoid. And you know what? The truth is, I might be worse. there's a really good chance I am. But if I don't understand that or try to deal with it, I'm not going to get any better. So, yeah, I might have to take a couple, knocks and just ask that question seriously. Like, okay, what is this dude doing? Like, what can I learn from him? Can I help him? Like, that's another thing, too, with working with creative people that just blows my mind of, You know, I've had a studio for a number of years with some friends, but we're not like a big name. I don't even think we're really professional, to be honest, because, you know, I've thought about what does it mean to be a professional? And I think, you know, a friend of mine who is a professional gave me a good definition, which is, you know, you're a professional when other professionals hire you a second time. Like then you,
yeah.
Like if they hire you once, it could just be, oh, that was a mistake. But if real pros who actually have, you know, a good reputation and are doing real good work, if they hire you a second time, then you're on to something. You know, then at least you, it's not just about credibility. It's about collaboration. And if you're good at collaborating, and that means like, look, I'll do anything. I'll tape stuff to the floor. I'll go get your coffee. You know, I'll carry stuff. You know, I'll rewrite things. I'll proofread your scripts. You know, I'll do whatever it takes to be in that room and contribute on some level to someone who's already doing work. Then that's good. But if my thing is, well, I'm a professional because I get paid. Well, fuck, who gives a shit? Like, that's not being a professional. That's being a whore. that's not the same thing, right? It's not because, you know, you're doing great work that you're getting paid. There's a lot of reasons you could get paid. But, or you could say, well, I have a reputation in the community. I'm like, what community? Like, well, you know, the other hobbyist community. It's like, don't tell a pro that. Don't tell a pro that you think you're good because you're, you know, an inspiration to other hobbyists, because that makes you a hobbyist. It doesn't make you an aspiring professional. And it hurts me on some level, because I think, God, if you could just get this idea that you could really be good if you're willing to work with other people who are good. Like, yeah, I get it that you're not going to look as good as them. You're not as good as them.
But where did they start, and where did you start, and where do you want to end up?
Yeah. And that's part of, like, we started this conversation talking about luck. That's what luck is to me. Like, if I could be in the room with people who are clearly better at stuff than I am, at something that I am interested in or maybe really passionate about, and they let me in there, well, I clearly cannot perform at the same level that they do, but they let me there anyway. That's luck, man. Like, that's, I can't control that. I can't, you know, make that happen. And I've read tons of those books, and I've, you know, written articles, and I've done, you know, all kinds of seminars and things where I've had that, you know, that thing, that advice I've tried to tell people, figure out what you want and then come up with a plan and work the plan and make it happen. It's like, yeah, but sometimes you got to just say, I'm going to just follow somebody else's plan for a little bit.
Yeah.
And if they won't let me in the room, I got to figure out what's it going to take. Like, I can't go to Steven Spielberg and get a meeting with him, or Christopher Nolan, or, you know, Tarantino, or anybody. You know, that's not going to happen, because they're going to say, who the fuck is this guy? Like, the first thing they're going to ask is what has this guy done? Like, why have you not already heard of him? It's like, well, that means I got to do something, and then I got to have something worth talking about. And I can't just say, well, fuck them. They're the elites. And, you know, they just don't care about people like me. I'm like, they used to be people like me.
Mm-hmm.
Like, but they worked and they worked with other people. And now, you know, now they've got something. I don't have anything until I start. And it's going to be terrible when I try to do it. But I'm going to have to get better. And that's fun. That's fun, like, because I work with a lot of companies, and, like, almost all the stories that these companies tell you are the early stories where they sucked.
Yeah.
You know, that's the good story. Like, I sucked, but then I figured it out. And then I sucked at the next thing, and then I figured that out. Like, it's not like the stories, if everything went great, they're not good stories.
It's boring.
Yeah, it'd be like saying, I got this story, this idea I want to pitch to you, Matt, about doing the film. So tell me what you think about this. It's about this teenager. He's 19. He's kind of snotty-nosed. He's bored out of his mind. He lives on this farm, you know, in the middle of nowhere with his aunt and his uncle. And, you know, one day these robots show up, and one of them has a message with a hologram from this princess who's saying, hey, come, you know, take care of me. So he hops in his X-Wing that he had out back. He drives over, picks her up, and they go cruising around. Like, that story would suck. You're like, wait a minute. Like, it was easy. Like, he didn't have to do anything. He didn't have to struggle. He didn't have to deal with his dad. You know, he didn't have to, you know, get a mentor to kind of tell him, you know, you need to suck it up, buddy, and like grow up. He didn't have to have some weird ass, you know, swaggering pirate kind of dude and his big, you know, Wookiee friend, you know, and have to, you know, say, well, I can be a better pilot than you. And of course, you know, in Star Wars, Han Solo is like, fuck you, kid. Like, you haven't done shit. Like, I don't care that you don't like me and that you think you can do it. Like, that's just, you got to do stuff. And when you do stuff and it's hard, then let's talk. Then it's a good movie.
Right.
But no conflict, no struggle, no problem. I mean, our stories are really about if the problem was good. If the problem sucks, the story sucks.
I listen to what people complain about, and it sort of affects my judgment of them and sort of what I think they're spending their time on.
Yeah.
Because if they complain about traffic or the Game of Thrones ending or, you know, stuff like that, like, and that's it. Like, you know, I'll just conversationally, like, you know,
right.
We're just shooting the breeze, right? But if they don't bring up like, oh man, like I'm working on this thing at work or something interesting and creative and like a real challenge, like a real problem. Mm-hmm. And if I never hear that, I just kind of like, I don't cut them off, but I'm just kind of like, I wonder what you're really focused on.
Yeah.
But if they're like, man, we've got this supplier, we got this and whatever the case is. Then I get interested and then we start having a real conversation. Then I start thinking kind of like you do about connecting people. And oh, you know what? You got to go talk to Sean. You get like, let's figure this out. Let's do something interesting.
Yeah.
So yeah, I kind of pay attention to what people's problems are.
Yeah. I think that's really super wise. I need to do that more.
Yeah.
You know, and I do respect people who care about something enough to want to do something, to motivate them to do something.
Yeah.
Because, you know, complaining about stuff, I mean, we can do it for fun. It builds some rapport sometimes. So I don't want to completely dismiss it. I mean, I do it from time to time too. But if you're really looking to say, hey, if I'm going to work with somebody and I'm going to make a commitment, it's a good idea to say, okay, what problems are you really passionate about? Like, and what problems have you solved or tried to? Because if the problem is, you know, I'm just trying to figure out how to get through the day, it's like, all right, I don't know that I can work with that. And then doing coaching, you know, so I used to do a lot of coaching. You know, I worked with Tony Robbins back in the 90s, it was great. It was fun. It was exciting. You know, we would do 500-600 person seminars on a regular basis, which is nothing for Tony, but for us, that was really pretty amazing. I mean, just having the chance to do it was really, really cool. But what I realized was, you know what? Number one, when the seminars were over, I'm like, where'd everybody go? Like, are you doing anything with any of this stuff? Like, I can't learn and I can't have the same level of skin in the game if I'm not going to look you in the eye later and have you come back and say, here's what I did, and it worked or it didn't work or whatever. And I couldn't learn. Like, if you applied it, I didn't get the stories. So, I mean, I never want to dismiss, you know, the opportunity, you know, which was amazing. And at the same time, I was like, the other thing is we're working with individuals. I mean, it could be 500-600 people, but it's all individuals, like usually entrepreneurs. Or people who are struggling or trying to make a decision or change in their life, which I respect. And at the same time, I'm like, but you're going to go back and see your life surrounded by people who have been kind of an example of where you were. And now you're going to go disrupt everything. And without that level of support, it just makes it tough and it makes it feel somewhat disingenuous. Now, I'm not saying that it didn't work. I'm just saying I didn't know that it did. I couldn't get that confirmation. So I started moving my focus to working with groups. And even when we did the seminars, we stopped letting people pay for others. Like if you were going to like send your team from your company, well, that was great. But like 80% of the people quit after the seminar was over.
Right.
And it felt like, man, we felt like bad that the company is paying for people to come quit. So I'm like, I can't do that. Like, so, but I'd like to figure out a way to get that group to stay cohesive in some ways and support one another and hopefully evolve together as a team, because then I think you can change the world. You know, there's that Margaret Mead quote of, you know, don't be surprised that the world's going to change through the concerted efforts of some small group, because that's the way it always works.
Right.
I didn't get the words exactly right, but you get the idea. I mean, I'm sure you know that quote better than I do, but you know, I've just found that, you know, the challenge with working with individuals is it's hard to do it by yourself. And even trying to do it, like, why? Like, that's been a theme of this discussion. Like, why are you trying to do this on your own? Is it because you're trying to prove something to somebody or yourself? Like the best stuff comes from helping other people. I mean, I don't mean that like in a sentimental, sappy way. I mean, like, you're not going to do anything good that just pleases you. Like, it's going to suck. Like, and I look back on my own career and go back to the lucky thing of being able to work with these amazing people. And you're an amazing person. Like, I'm thrilled that I get a chance to talk to you, whether it's on a podcast or not, because you're a pretty amazing guy. You know, and I take that really seriously. And I respect it. And I'm like, I am thankful that you're giving me this opportunity. I seriously am. And I think to myself, you know, anything I've ever done that's any good, I've always done with other people. And hopefully for other people to benefit, not just for our own little group to get something. It's for something that we feel like we're doing for other people. Now, on the other hand, like anything that I've ever done that I'm ashamed of, that was all me, man. I'll take total responsibility for that I just, you know, fucked up. But the good stuff has never been, and I don't know of any counterexamples. I've never met anybody who I thought did something that really inspired me that was only for them.
That's a great way to look at it, right?
I mean, if you can come up with a counterexample, or anybody, you know, in the comments for the podcast or whatever, I'd love to see, you know, because I'd love learning from challenging, you know, my thinking and having other people do it. But I can't think of a single thing that anybody's ever done that's great that was just for them. And that's the challenge. You know, self-help is too much self, man. You know, personal development is too much personal. It's like, you know, there's thousands of books and seminars and webinars and newsletters. And I mean, there's so much shit out there. I mean, I'm not going to say that it doesn't help. I'm just saying it's not enough. Like, if you're just I'm going to do my affirmations, or I'm going to do my, you know, morning routine or whatever. Like, I do that stuff too. But man, if that's the end of it, then God, like, why are you doing it?
Yeah. And why would you have a job or live in a neighborhood or be in a family, right? You could do all that stuff and be a hermit. And then what's the point of becoming better than you are if you're the only person measuring that, if you're measuring yourself?
Yeah. And it's deep, you know, it runs deep in human psychology. And, you know, the biggest punishment that you can give somebody is put them in a prison. And then to take it further than that is put them in solitary confinement.
Mm, yeah.
Which I'm sure a lot of people think, man, I would love that. I would love to have just a moment with myself. And I could just not have to deal with anybody. And I could just have complete quiet.
Our mutual friend, Crystal, for example. Ask her that story.
Did you?
About being having some time in jail. I'll let you find that story from her off the air. But
yeah.
She's one. Yeah.
Yeah. She's an amazing person, too.
Oh, without a doubt.
Yeah.
She would have a harder time hearing that than I think I would. You know, I can appreciate the compliment and respect it and understand it in the context that you're giving it. But yeah, like we need to work with her on how to accept the compliment.
Yeah.
Because you are amazing, Crystal.
Yes, she is. And she's listening to this, like, Crystal, seriously, like, you're disrespecting our opinion of you by not agreeing you're amazing.
We're right and you're wrong.
Yeah, I'm always telling her, I want to be your agent. Like, you know, you have so much amazing talent and, you know, I'd love to figure out ways for more people to see it. But at the same time, I've also learned, or I guess I haven't learned, I'll just admit, I have not learned this lesson, which is I get overly enthusiastic about people sometimes.
I do too.
To the point where I overstep it. You know, I do, like, I'm like, I'm going to do this for you and this for you. And they're like, they don't want it. Like, I should have asked them. Like, if I'm going to do something for you, Matt, I should ask, Matt, do you want me to do this? Because if the answer is no, maybe I shouldn't. You know, maybe we could talk about it. But I'm like, I'm going to do it for you anyway. And you're going to think it's great. And you're like, Sean, what the fuck? Like, you just complicated my life. And I didn't want you to do that. I remember I was looking for a position when I was working at this company in Colorado Springs. And I really needed somebody who had some significant analytics skills, particularly some statistics for some work we were doing. And I was going through resumes one day, kind of cleaning out some of the files on our current employees. And I found that this woman who worked for us already had like the perfect background. And she was just, you know, at the time working part-time, doing, you know, odds and ends and kind of helping with reception and things like that. And I'm like, wow, like, I didn't realize you had this. And I took her out to lunch and I got all excited. And I'm like, you know, this is exactly what we're looking for. And then she came in the next day and quit. And I'm like, what? Why? She was like, because I don't want to do all that stuff that you just talked about, Sean. Like, that's why I don't do it anymore. Like, I used to do it and I didn't like it and I hate it and I never want to do it again.
Wow.
Just because I have the competence, that doesn't mean I want to do it. And I'm like, oh, I'm so sorry, but you don't have to do it. Like, I was just, you know, I'm like, you don't have to quit. And she's like, yeah, dude, because now, like, every time I come in here, you're going to be disappointed in me and I'm not living up to my potential. I'm like, holy shit. Like, what did I do? Like, like, oh my God. And that, I mean, that was years ago. And I, every time I think about that, it feels like being punched in the stomach. I'm like, what a fucking asshole I was. And I have to say, I've done that over and over again. And and Crystal, again, if you're listening, I promise I will try not to do it. if I start doing it, please just say, Sean, back off, man. Seriously.
I will agree with your statement up to a point with that lady in the Springs.
Mm-hmm.
And the point where I switched over was her assumption that you'd be disappointed in her. You don't strike me as someone that would... I think you would accept her as she is. And at that point in that story, that's where it went from your actions and what you were trying to do for her. And that went to now she's trying to hook her freight train of baggage to you. And that's where kind of like, you weren't being an asshole, right? You saw the path, you saw the capability, but I just couldn't see you being disappointed in her. And so that's when like the story for me diverged and like, that's now her responsibility for that.
Well, yeah, I appreciate that. And I think, you know, because I've thought about this a lot and it's happened so long ago. I'm like, even if that's true to her, it was, you know,
that's her reality though.
Yeah. And it probably didn't come from just out of nowhere.
Right.
It could have, you know, it could have been, you know, I reminded her of somebody who did that or whatever. I mean, that stuff happens, but it's very possible that because she knew me, that she saw all the stuff that I did that I didn't think I was doing, that maybe I would have done that. And that's one of the reasons why it hurts, because, you know, if we're criticized and it's clearly not true, like it doesn't bother you. Like if I said, you know, Matt, you're a Martian, You'd be like, what the fuck? Like, are you talking metaphorically? I'm like, no, you're literally a Martian. You'd be like, you're nuts. Like, you would laugh. Because you wouldn't take any offense to it, because it's just, it has no basis of reality. But if I said something that hit a little bit close to home, then you'd be like,
Right.
You know, so the only criticisms that typically bug us are ones that have some truth in them.
Yeah.
Otherwise, you know, why would you care? It's like, well, that's clearly not true. Like, let's just move on.
When I was 22 and had my first job at Valley Lab up in Boulder, so I was a software engineer, and I immediately gravitated towards the sales and marketing department and not knowing why, but looking back, they were a lot more fun than the engineers were.
Yeah.
And the guy who was a marketing guy, Bill Kingston, and I've tried to track him down. He just doesn't have a digital footprint, and I have lost track. But it was within the first 2 months of graduating school as an engineer, working in the engineering department, he's like, you should come work for me in marketing. And I had no idea what that would look like. And I was stuck in my little box of, well, I went to school as an engineer. I got hired as an engineer. Mm-hmm. I should be an engineer. And then 10 years later, I was like, fuck this. I'm not an engineer, right? I'm glad I had the the schooling and the discipline to think kind of like processes, but at the front end and not in the implementation end. But I would like to go find Bill and go, dude, you're absolutely right.
Yeah.
But I didn't have the skill set. Like, I didn't know how to learn a new skill. And part of it was the confidence, and part of it was the the knowledge on the self-development and going, well, I'm going to be here, I'm going to go there. And so, kind of like you, it's like, if you want to go meet Spielberg, well, let's figure out something that's going to get his attention.
Yeah.
But I just didn't have... I was under-equipped in many facets at that point, even. Like, to me, he could have said astronaut or circus clown or president of the U.S. It didn't matter what change he wanted to see in me. I wouldn't have been able to process it.
Yeah. Yeah, and it's challenging, too, because, man, like, life gets complicated really fast.
Yeah.
And, like, even when you're saying, like, if you're going to try to do something to get somebody's attention... Well, then it becomes, I don't want to say tainted, but like you kind of know, like when somebody's doing something to try to get something from you, it's even if it's good, it just doesn't feel right. Like we both have kids. So we're, you know, kids are really great at saying they can read the mood and say, hey, dad, can I help you with anything? You know, because you know where that's going to go.
Right.
So it's a normal human thing. But, yeah, I mean, it'd be interesting if somebody knows Bill out there and can track him down.
Yeah, I'll look after we get done. It's like once a year I'll kind of tell that story and go, man, I wonder what's what. But he would have been a great mentor, but yeah. I still think about that. And I kind of like just want to show him that he was right.
Yeah. Yeah, I met a woman at this conference a couple of years ago, and she was great. She was, you know, like, man, that her topic was the one I really wanted to see out of all the stuff on the schedule, and she did a really great job. And I was taking, you know, furious notes the whole time she was speaking, and I had all these follow-up questions that I wanted to ask her. And then just like in my life, you know, she sat down after it was over right next to me. I'm like, this is just how things work for me. Like, I don't know how. But you know what, man, I'm going to take it. And so we got to know each other pretty well. And it turned out we both went to Penn State. We both had the same cognitive psychology mentor. And I thought my mentor had died.
Like, oh, no kidding.
I thought he had died of lupus. Like at a really, because when I met him, he was really young for someone in that position. He was super, you know, productive, and he was managing tons of projects, and yeah, just an amazing, amazing guy. His name is Rich Carlson. And I thought he died. And then she said no. Like, she's 9 years younger than me. And she's like, no, like, he was my mentor too. And I'm like, no way. Like, that's, and of course it's like, who's stalking who now? This is just a little too weird. But then I found out he's still teaching at Penn State, like, right now. Like, he's been there 40 years or whatever. And I wrote him an email because I just had to say, hey, I met this woman who also worked, and we were both talking about how amazing you are and how you changed both of our lives. And we still, you know, to this day, are grateful for what you did for us. And you probably have no clue, like, what impact you actually had. But I don't know that I can capture it in words, but I want to at least try and say thank you because, like, wow. I didn't tell him that I thought he was dead. I thought that'd be kind of, kind of rude. But, and then he wrote back and said, you know, I don't remember you, honestly, but I appreciate you, you know, writing that message. And that's like the best feedback anybody could ever hope is that you made a difference for somebody in a way that you couldn't anticipate. It wasn't like a recipe for success. It wasn't like, you know, all the stuff that, you know, I would typically try to teach or learn myself. If you want this result, do these things, and model the behavior of someone who's already achieved it and do the same exact steps. Like, that procedural stuff, it can be useful, but it can also be really, it could be its own kind of little prison.
True.
You're going to have to just open yourself up a little bit. You know, because I, you know, from a, you know, just when growing up as a, you know, an Irish Catholic, you know, I
another thought, thing we have in common.
Yeah. And I'm not technically even Irish because I'm adopted, so I have no idea what my actual heritage was. But nevertheless, I grew up in an Irish family, you know, and the I was an altar boy, the whole thing, right? But over time, you know, what I really started to think was I'm kind of an enthusiastic agnostic. That's kind of where my thinking got to at a relatively young age. And I'm, again, very grateful for people who helped me even think through that. Because for what that means for me is I don't know what's going to happen. Like, I don't know why anything happens. And that's what I like about it. Like, the fact that I don't have it figured out makes it interesting. You know, it's part of the curiosity that drives almost everything I do. It's part of me appreciating when I meet somebody who I think is an asshole that maybe I'm wrong. Like, maybe I get that I judge them because that's a reflex almost, but it gives me hopefully at least a moment to say, but wait a second, like, you don't know. Like, why are you going to make a commitment that you figured out that someone's, you know, evil or bad or stupid or whatever when you don't even know? Like, give them some slack, man. Like, try to figure out what's going on, and if there's going to be a relationship, at least try. It doesn't mean it's always going to work, but, like, I don't know a lot of people that I don't, you know, that I have hard feelings about.
Yeah.
And if I do, like, I know that I contributed to it every single time. Like, I could think of specific things I did to piss them off. So the fact that they don't like me, I'm sorry. I doubt that they would listen to this. But anybody out there that I pissed off, I really am sorry. And I didn't mean to do it, but and I probably can't fix it, but I'll try with the next person. I'll do the best I can because I know you're the same way in terms of the curiosity driving you. And that's, I mean, having big problems and having curiosity, man, those are pretty, like, if you tell me tomorrow, I want you to meet this person who's got big problems and is really curious about life, I'll talk to them. That's good enough for me if you recommend them.
Yeah. Well, and I think the luck, as you're describing that, I think the luck, and I consider myself lucky as well. And there's been times in my life when I didn't feel that way, but I think it comes from the curiosity, I think, is a huge part of that. And I think also having as clear a head as you possibly can have in today's environment between the traffic and the social media and the day-to-day responsibilities, but putting up, I talk a lot about my mental diet. Mm-hmm. I have a very healthy mental diet. Like, I don't watch the murder porn shows and reality TV shows. I want to watch something that is challenging or inspiring and try not to get mired in the littlest details. Like, if there's dishes in the sink or the laundry or whatever the case is, but I find that the luck comes from having a clear-ish head and then looking at something and going, I wonder either why or who or how. And then I think there's a little bit of courage, might be too strong of a word, but just asking that question, and just whether it's an email or asking somebody at the store or a phone call or anything like that, and just those circles kind of intersecting into that, and just like, then stuff happens. And then it's like, oh, I feel lucky. And it's like, well, a little bit more encouragement, and then bigger challenges, things like that.
Yeah. Yeah, I like that idea. I like that spirit too. And I think, you know, like if you're into like the law of attraction or the secret or whatever, you know, all that stuff. I mean, I understand, you know, on some level where I think people are trying to get to with that idea. But when we were saying that, you know, one of the things that kind of popped into my head was, I think of luck as like the good stuff that happens to you that you did nothing to get.
Yeah.
Like you didn't do, like, you know, and any of these things we just talked about, like, so when, you know, Jen got done and sat next to me, I didn't like mind control her, like, to do it. Like, I know some people would say, well, you know, you did it. You put that out the intention of the universe, and you're like, God, that sounds so manipulative and so terrible on some level. It's like, I didn't do anything to make that happen. It just happened, and it was a good thing. And yes, I want to feel somewhat in control of my destiny, and I want to help other people feel more control too. But at the same time, I'm like, most of the stuff that's happening to you, you did nothing. Like we're sitting here in this beautiful place that you've made, you know, with all this cool stuff that you collected, but you didn't write these books. You know, you didn't build the walls.
Nope.
You know, you didn't invent electricity. You didn't come up with the idea of podcasting. Like, you didn't do any of that stuff. You're a super creative, cool guy. But most of what we have, and that's, you know, we didn't do anything. We just got it. It was just given to us.
Mm-hmm.
And it's cool.
Yeah. And I'm feeling appreciative about that, too.
Yeah. I think
that's another component, too.
Yeah. And I know you're into stoicism and, you know, saying, you know what, if I can get through hard things, then it makes me stronger. You know, it makes me more appreciative of, you know, the opportunities that do just come to me that I did nothing to deserve. And I have no idea how any of this stuff happens. I would like to know, but I don't know that I can. I don't know that my brain is big enough for us to figure out any of this stuff, or maybe that's true for all of us.
Yeah. And I think it almost, yeah, with the stoicism, and I'm a big Stephen Pressfield fan. So the War of Art and the 300 and Thermopylae, the gods, right? I think it angers the gods if you question that, right?
Yeah.
Like if you're given something mystical, magical, like, you know, your phone rings, it's like, I was just thinking about you, or you're checking Facebook and you get a message from somebody and say, you know, it's all physics and electrons and stuff. And I think just to sort of look for how the trick is done, I just don't want to do it. I don't want to know. It's like, that's cool and I'm good.
Yeah. 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 It's pretty amazing. And again, I think through, I mean, and it's, first of all, again, I really appreciate you even having this conversation, and hopefully it benefits other people listening, because, you know, just being asked the questions and thinking through this or having the dialogue, you know, this is what I'm trying to encourage other people to do. Like, you can come to experts, and there's definitely value. Like, if you want a teacher who can actually show you how to play guitar, for example, they will save you a lot of time. But if you only follow their method and you don't try anything different, you're missing things that a little bit of chaos, mm-hmm. and a little bit of just experimenting and just doing weird shit from time to time. Those things become available if you're willing to just have conversation and just listen, which I know is one of your core skills. And listening sounds like you're not doing anything. It's like, you are. Like, the fact that you're listening makes all this other stuff possible. And without that, like, nothing happens.
So true.
Like, one of my other mentors, you know, that I didn't really get a chance to work with very much directly, but I still think of him as a mentor, was Timothy Leary. So when I got out of college, you know, I had a degree in psychology and clinical depression, you know, as in a degree in psychology and clinical depression, because I was like so unsatisfied with, you know, the answers I was getting and the apathy that was surrounding a lot of the people that were professionals about, we just don't know how this stuff works. And, you know, if you look at the studies, 33% of the people who get clinical treatment get better, 33% stay the same, 33% get worse. And in control groups, it's the same. Like, so in other words, you got theories, you have ideas, you're certain about how this stuff works, but you can't execute it. You can't make it, you know, you can't make a clear difference. So when I started reading his books right after I got out of college, you know, I wrote him and I thought, I don't know if he'll write me back. But he did on a couple of occasions. And his thing, which is really subtle, it took me a long time to get it, was the theme that ran through almost all of his work was this idea of empowering the individual. But it wasn't about the individual. That was the part that I didn't really get, which was what he was really saying was, if you're going to be an individual and you can express yourself and you can kind of choose who you're going to be and you could, you know, all that stuff is great. But the way you do it is you do it in fast feedback in small groups, you know, where you can actually help each other. Hmm. Because, you know, and his, all of the tools that he created, you know, in the early days that got him to Harvard, that led to the psychedelic studies and everything else, when all that stuff was legal, strangely enough, people forget that sometimes. But, you know, at the time he was doing interpersonal diagnosis of personality and worked with colleagues to create that method and kind of group therapy, you know, back when it was considered to be, you know, almost illegal. You know, the metaphor was like, well, you wouldn't let surgeons like operate on each other. Like, why would you let, you know, people like, they're because we're not psychoanalyzing each other. Like, we're trying to give each other feedback. So if you're saying, hey, Sean, you're being too dominant in this conversation, well, if you give me that info, then I can make an adjustment, or I can at least choose to or not. But if I don't listen to you, then good luck, man. Like, you're just rolling the dice. But if you can give me some feedback meaning it's going to help me move towards a better place, then, wow, maybe I could do the same thing for you. It doesn't have to be one way. You know, and why restrict that to group therapy? Like, why not just do that in life in general and encourage other people to do it? And certainly the best in the business world, for sure, but probably in personal life too, the best results I've ever been able to help, you know, get started are getting people to listen to each other. And I'm not great at listening. You're way better than I am. Like, I suck at listening. I can talk all day. You can leave, and I probably wouldn't even know you left.
Just hit the stop button when you're done. I'm going to go for a ride. No, I had to work on that a lot, actually, because of the ADD and getting my hands around that and figuring out that, you know, being present and active listening. And, you know, that's why I take notes. You know, it's like kind of funny, like on dates, like I wish I had a notepad, because then
it might be a little creepy.
Well, the first seven said that, and then I was like, oh, I'll just secretly record you and I'll send it off for transcription later. Totally kidding. You can't prove a thing. but yeah, it's hard because, and again, just becoming aware of like how to listen, because it's not dialogue. I'm not waiting for you to stop talking so I can say something. We're not trying to advance a scene. It's like, I really want to, like, I know all I know, but I'm like, if I shut up, then I'll learn what you know. And that's way more interesting to me, but staying present. And then I actually had to learn, here was another skill I figured out. I don't know where, but letting questions go. Mm-hmm. And kind so of
what does that mean?
So, like, let's say, you know, you've talked about many, many things, and I've had questions that, you know, before I worked on listening and be like, oh, well, let me ask you about, like, you know, Tony Robbins, or let me ask you about, you know, Timothy Leary and blah, blah, blah. And it's like, maybe I'll come back to that. Like, I'll just try to put like a post-it note in my head. And if it's still interesting at that point, then I'll come back to it. But I can just go, I don't have to ask every single question. Mm-hmm. Like, it's not that important. And so kind of like the ones that will stick are the ones that I want to ask. But like, yeah. But again, and thinking, and maybe starting a conversation going, maybe there's no question here.
Yeah, I like that. That's a cool idea. I remember, you know, for a while, like if I was doing like formal, leadership training or things like that, I mean, you have to give content, right? There's got to be something that at least people to react to. And one of the things is this idea of an elevator pitch.
Right.
So, you know, where you're kind of, you're familiar with that concept. And what I realized over time was I get like having some clarity of your thinking so you can communicate it succinctly. Not one of my core skills either. you know, verbosity is an art form. But what I also realized in just like looking at when does it actually really work? And I think kind of like it's almost like what you do, you know, and I was going to say that you do naturally. It just appears that you do naturally, that you clearly, as you mentioned, have learned how to do, which is not so much pitching people, but really asking questions. So, for example, if you do use the classic idea, you get in the elevator, you got a minute or whatever to, you know, pitch this person who could potentially help you on what you're doing. Well, a better way, I think, is to just engage somebody. Like, instead of saying, I've got a minute, it's like, a minute to do what? Like, to tell them what you're doing?
Yeah.
And who you are? Like, that sucks. Like, why wouldn't you just say, instead of saying, well, this is what I do, I'm, you know, I remember once when I was working at, you know, AT&T back a long time ago, I was having some issues with one of my colleagues in the IT department, and they didn't have any leadership over there. And we were struggling, and they kept spending more money. And I had to, you know, onboard all these people onto this project, plus do all the work that I was responsible for too. And it was really frustrating. And we hired a chief information officer, and I was reading this guy's profile, and I thought, you know what? I wonder if I can talk to him because maybe he can help me squash this issue. And I literally went across the street. I was on my way to Seattle later that day. And I get in the elevator. It's just me and this other guy. Well, I'm a relatively extroverted person, as you can probably guess. I didn't know him. So my first reaction, if I meet somebody in that environment and I don't know who they are, the first thing I think is, who the fuck are they? Like, why don't I know them? Because I'm supposed to know everybody.
Right.
So I'm like, hey, man, like, who are you? And he told me, you know, I'm Joe. And I'm like, oh, you're the new chief information officer. And I thought, I'm literally in an elevator, you know, where I could do an elevator pitch and say, hey, please do this thing. But, you know, normally what I would have done if I was trained was I'd say, well, you know, when he asked me, well, who are you? I would have said, well, I'm Sean Kern, I'm executive director, blah, blah, blah. I've got this team. I've got it. Like, I'm not going to do that. What I did was instead say, well, you know what, Joe, right now I'm trying to figure out a way to deal with this company that we keep hiring all these contractors from and wasting all this money. Now I knew because where he had come from. So he had been at Arthur Anderson, and the company that was driving me crazy was Anderson Consulting, who later became Accenture. And this was right after the big break and the Enron thing. And, you know, there was a lot of tension between those two groups, and I knew they had different philosophies. So I knew if I dropped the bomb that, you know, most likely his competitor was bugging me, he'd want to talk to me. So that was totally manipulative. No question about it. But I just said, yeah, I'm trying to figure out a way to deal with these Anderson Consulting people who were wasting all of our money. He said, well, where are they wasting money? I said, well, I guess technically in your department, Joe. And he's like, hmm. No, it's only a two-story building. So this is a short elevator ride. So now he's like holding the door open. And he's like asking me all these questions. And he's like, can we talk about this? I'm like, I'm getting ready to head to Seattle. I mean, I'd be happy when I get back. So he's like, okay. So I get to Seattle and I get a phone call from Joe's executive assistant. And she said, hey, you know, Joe wanted me to call you and tell you that he got rid of all the Anderson people. and I thought, okay, yeah. So it was not something I planned, but I did kind of do in the moment. But I later realized, okay, yes, it was arguably manipulative. But later I started thinking, well, why did that work? And why it worked was I just asked really a question as opposed to trying to spew out in a minute all this factual information that would be lost anyway. And the question was, how do I handle this problem? I recommend people think about this. Still, you still can have your speech, you know, if you want to do it. But if you really are in that moment where you get a chance to meet somebody who could really help you, you know, what's in it for them, obviously. But like we talked about earlier, what's a big problem that's worth solving that they care about? And say, I'm working on that. You don't have to explain your whole history. I've been with this company for 25 years and I've done 15 different things and I've won these awards. And like, just say, look, this is what I'm working on now. And if they are interested, they might say, huh, let's keep talking. Like keeping talking would be a good thing instead of, oh, I got, you know, to the end of that minute and I gave them everything they need to know. So we never need to talk again.
Right. Well, and going back to, I wanted to ask you, have you ever read Influence by Robert Cialdini?
Yeah, Cialdini, yeah.
Yeah, like I've recommended that book a ton this year because I listened to the audiobook and I was laughing or shaking my head at like how much I've been influenced or manipulated, or you had used the word sociopath before.
Yeah.
And so I'm kind of like, that word gets kind of a bad rap.
Yeah. You know, it's a survival skill.
Yeah, it depends how you use it. I think I'm a closeted sociopath. I don't know.
There's a certain acceptable level in our culture.
Correct.
Because if you think about it, like if you listen to anything on the news and you really listen and you don't emotionally freak out, like how could you, like if you hear stories about somebody being raped and you're not outraged and you want to do something about it, like, but at the same time, if you are outraged and you can't do anything about it, that's not good for you either. So there has to be a certain level of I can hear this stuff and not emotionally react the way that I would if it happened like in my neighborhood, if it happened close to home, because I can disassociate from people who are farther away or not part of my normal group. And it's a necessary psychological survival skill to not be running out in the street every single time you hear something that's terrible.
Yeah.
But there is another side to it too, which you can take it too far, where like nothing really seems to, unless it's in your self-interest, you don't really care. And I think that's another challenge with, you know, the self-help and personal development work, which we're both really into. I mean, we both really read a lot of stuff. We read a lot of the same things. But if you take it to the point where, like, it's just all about me, like, that's a problem.
Yeah.
And it's a problem, not like, you know, a judgment, a moral judgment. I'm saying it's a problem in the sense that you, as the person who does that, are going to suffer consequences that will hurt you too. That it's not just that you're bad for society when you do that. It's that, and I shouldn't say you, anybody who does that.
Well, I might need a reminder.
Well, I know I do. There are many times where I think, what the fuck did I just do? I was not thinking like in a rational way. I was reacting. And I did something that I now regret because I was temporarily disconnected.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I noticed that the influential skills that I need on a daily basis for my job, I need to turn those off sometimes or dial them back and try to use them for good, as opposed to, they never go evil, but it's kind of like, mm-hmm. nobody wants to feel manipulated.
Yeah.
And I can candidly admit that I'm good, I guess, on the out, it's the end result, whether it's influence or manipulation, right? And so I'm good at both of those things. And I definitely don't want to be a manipulator. But being like an influencer, like, you know, you're trying to coach up that woman in the Springs. You're trying to influence her to go back and utilize her skills. You weren't manipulating her. So if I'm using those skills, I try to definitely make them good and helpful for somebody else.
Yeah. And, you know, it's interesting too, like if you study neurolinguistic programming, you know, which is fascinating and can be really interesting. I mean, the word manipulate also means to handle well, skillfully. So we do want to be skillful in the way we handle our relationships with people. And whether we like it or not, we're constantly manipulating one another. I mean, just by the every behavior we do, by what we wear, by who we talk to, like everything that comes out of our mouth or comes out of our body on some level is designed to be manipulative. And, you know, but if you're doing something where you're deliberately trying to hurt somebody and take pleasure in that, that's different. Where if it's like, I'm just trying to help you give me something.
Yes, thank you.
Like, I'm helping you give me what I want.
I love that. I gotta write that one down. Yes. Helping you give me what I want.
Like, we were having a debate with some friends the other day. I probably shouldn't say this on the air, but I'll try to self-censor a bit. But we're like talking about the difference between being an asshole and being like another word that's, you know, that starts with a C. I'll just say that.
Maybe a different gender.
Yeah.
I got it.
And what we were saying was, well, an asshole is aggressive and does things to, you know, get what they want despite what it means for other people. And they just justify it, right? They can say, well, it's because they're a loser or because they're an idiot, or they can justify it in their brain, and they can do it sometimes very quickly. It may not make any sense to anybody else, but it works for them. And like, yes, I get it. I did something that was kind of wrong, but it was right because of this reason. Whereas the other thing is like, they do the same thing, but they don't even think about it. It's like totally clueless. Like, they don't justify it because they think it's just fine. So, so like the person who cuts you off on traffic, who's like, you know, because like, well, you're just going too slow, or because, like, as soon as they say because, they're an asshole. But when they just did it, and they're completely clueless about how it affects other people, then it's the other. Like, we maybe have to come up with a better word, but I'm like, I thought it was an interesting, you know, thought experiment of, you know, there's so, you hear people talk about how mad they are about people being entitled. It's like, well, the only reason you would be mad about somebody who feels like they're entitled is because you feel like you're entitled. Like, well, I don't think they deserved it, but I do. They have to do the same thing I did to get what they're getting. And only I deserve it. Only I'm entitled to that. And they haven't done the work. I was like, wow, man. Like, especially the stereotype of, you know, the older person talking about these goddamn kids, you know, who don't appreciate a goddamn thing. You know, I was told that almost, it feels like every day by my father. But like, that's just, yeah, I get it. Like, that's a recurring kind of theme when it comes to how generations treat each other, right? Older generations think that, you know, these kids, you know, have it easy. And the kids think that the parents are just trying, or the authorities are kind of just trying to, you know, hold them down. And, but I'm like, you know, every time you say these goddamn kids, what you're really saying is, I think I deserve it and they don't.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, well, how is that not entitlement? Like, but I have a deserving entitlement.
Oh, man. I would have loved to have been part of that conversation. Yeah. It's almost like the C word side of that you're talking about is the more, maybe, what's the word I'm looking for? Like, I wanted to say animal side of that, where there's no consciousness, right? Like, yeah, I was reading one of these books and they were talking about how humans are the only species that would know if a human next to them dropped dead. Like, we have a concept of that.
Yeah.
You know, like, you know, some animal on the plains gets shot, like the buffalo drops dead next to them. They don't know what happened. They just see something, right? So it's almost like the, you know, the C word, as you defined it, is like less evolved because they just react and don't even think there's any repercussions to that.
Yeah, and sometimes I think what it is,
and that's not a gender comment, but
no. I think it comes down to a lot of times is being distracted.
Yeah.
So I mentioned, you know, Rich Carlson, you know, at Penn State, you know, who's this amazing guy who's influenced probably thousands and thousands of people directly or indirectly by just the stuff that he did and continues to do. And what we were working on, you know, back in the 80s when I was, you know, in school, was something called attention switching, which, you know, that term makes a lot more sense than multitasking. Because multitasking, we just know we can't do. So if the person who's cutting you off is doing it because he just thinks you're going too slow and he's going to cut you off, you know, in the right lane, and he's going to, like, I saw a bumper sticker the other day that said, if I pass you on the right, you're an asshole. I'm like, wow. Like, they thought about this enough to have some self-awareness. And then to communicate that to other people. But that's an asshole, because they're justifying. They're saying, I'm doing this for a reason.
Yeah.
But the person who is doing it because they're, you know, on their phone, and they don't even know that they're driving recklessly, and they don't even know that they're going too fast compared to everybody else and cutting, swerving back and forth. That's the second thing, which is you're trying to attention switch. And when your attention is focused on this one thing, all this other stuff you're doing, you have no awareness of, you know, other than maybe a survival level that doesn't get you killed. But yeah, I mean, I think that's a consistent theme that keeps coming up. Like, when I would work with executives and do executive coaching, almost every single time, other than the imposter syndrome, which comes up, is this idea of, I've been so stressed in my job that now that I have a chance to stop and think, like, I don't even know what to do with my head.
Yeah.
Like, so if you try to meditate, you know, you kind of get that, you know, in your face somewhat. But I've had these people, and I was like this, you know, well, I worked at, you know, a company where I literally would have 24 appointments in a day. You know, I would be booked, triple booked, for half hour meetings all day. And I would show my kids, you know, look, this is, they'd say, what's your day look like? And I would show them, and they would be like, that's not possible. And I'm like, yeah. Like, what I'm doing is, I'm doing triage all day. Like, I'm on one call, half listening, and I'm on another call, sometimes on my cell phone, just listening for trigger words, you know, or keywords for me to jump in.
Yep.
And then I have IM for someone who's on the third call, letting me know whether I should jump onto one of those. And that is crazy making. But if you do it enough, it becomes normal.
Yes.
And then when you stop doing it, your brain is like, where's all the stimulus? You know, where's all the external, you know, signs of what I should be doing? Like, now I have to stop and actually think. And I couldn't do it. Like, it took me probably months.
Oh, I'm sure.
Before my brain would reset and I could actually have a thought that didn't originate from some external trigger.
I saw a woman at the grocery store yesterday that had, and I only noticed her because she was having a conversation over the speakerphone of her cell phone.
Yeah.
which it was fine. Like, I, again, like that is not going to be the problem I'm going to complain about. Yeah. Right. But I'm relaying the story in the context that she was able to have that conversation and shop. And I just wanted to ask her, you know, if I could go back and just ask her a question. I'm like, because if she can execute this, I'm envious, because I wanted to know if you got everything on your list and if you remember that conversation, because I can't do that.
Yeah.
And so then, to your point, I'd be curious, what is her stress level? Because are you going through this world like, oh man, I'm so busy and I gotta do this and this and this. And so you're dealing with the emotion of a phone call, and you've got the task management of the store, two very, very different things. Yeah. And then, like, are you going home agitated? Like, I didn't give a shit she was on her speakerphone, which is just rude, but whatever, but didn't affect me. I was just like studying her going, how effective are you? And how stressed does that make you? And if you do that all the time, right? So,
yeah, we just recently did a talk on, you know, how AI is going to take all of our jobs. So, and we did it for an HR audience, and we were totally serious, you know, and the way we did it was to try to take it, this idea, and make it fun. So, you know, I had a friend of mine, you know, who's amazing and super smart and very personable and charismatic. I mean, she's perfect for this thing. And, you know, what we wound up having her do was she comes on stage and immediately leaves, you know, with a tripod with an iPad on top of it. And I'm like, what's going on? She's like, I've been replaced. I'm like, what? And then she leaves. And, you know, and then she goes behind the stage, and she is, I talked to the iPad the whole time, and she's kind of there, you know, doing the voiceover. And, and really, you know, we use real examples of stuff that's happening right now. We just try to make it fun because it's such a charged topic, you know. And I think the bigger one, which we couldn't get there, you know, in that that session, which is, it's just too much of a leap, is what would you do if you didn't have a job? Because we kind of define ourselves many times based on our job. Like, when you ask somebody, like, who are you? The first thing that comes out of most of our mouth is, this is what I do. This is my job. Mm-hmm. And, you know, if you read, like, the 4-Hour Work Week, like, when I read that book, the first time I thought, well, fuck, like, what would I do if I only had to work 4 hours a week? Like, I don't know if I know what to do with myself. Like, I'd have to actually plan my own life. And that sounds great, but it is not, man. Like, you know, so my mom was amazing. I mean, she was, you know, very super outgoing. She was funny. You know, she was, you know, just a lot of fun to be around. And then when she finally got what she wanted, which was, you know, I want to retire and not have to have any responsibilities, she became depressed. She became a totally different person because she didn't have, you know, other people's agendas to, you know, kind of decide what she was going to do with her time. So she did nothing. Like, she would watch television and she would order from QVC, like, the same thing sometimes. Like, she didn't even open the last one and she ordered the same thing. You know, that's not good, right? And that happens to a lot of people, where anytime they do have free time, it creates anxiety of, like, I don't know what to do. And then if they don't have an answer, eventually the answer is, I'm not going to do anything.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, back to the AI conversation, you know, what I'm hoping people would take away from that, you know, that conversation, that talk, was, I need to start figuring out what I'm going to do with my time, where I'm going to have to make some decisions, and maybe I could do it with my friends. You know, like we talked about before, you don't have to figure it out on your own. But you're going to have the conversation about, what would you do if you didn't have to work?
I would have to find some challenges. And I think that humans need something to struggle against. Because for me, I'm energized by accomplishments, mm-hmm. and not pleasure in the sense of watching a movie or eating a bag of Oreos, but, you know, actually overcoming something. That's when I feel the most energized and fulfilled and actually at peace, right? Like if I've, and I felt this on Sunday, like I've paid my bills, I have some appointments set up for work, I've got, you know, this podcast this week, mm-hmm. I've actually done something, like I feel like I've contributed to anything from my own development or my company's development or my interests, like I've executed something. And it was great. I went for a run and I was like, I don't have a care in the world.
Yeah.
So I think if all those challenges are removed, then the brain will seek out something that'll make a mountain out of a molehill.
Yeah. Yeah. Like you were talking about before, you know, we're kind of somewhat defined by our problems and the ones that we choose to focus on and
yeah.
you know, give our energy to. And so when we're, you know, wrapping up that particular talk that we did, and it might be a good place to even end this conversation for today, because I'd love to keep talking, you know, maybe we could
do this
again,
part two,
which
yeah.
would be great.
Next time you come back, for sure.
Yeah, I'd love it. Yeah, I'd love it. I think it'd be fun. Is we came to the conclusion of, you know, essentially, you know, me as the human part saying, well, look, you know, fuck, if you're going to take our jobs, you know, you're smarter than us. Like you're smarter than all of humanity at some point, which is supposedly coming. You know, you could solve all of our problems. Like what's left for human beings? And, you know, her response, Andy's response was, well, look, there's one thing that humans can do that we can't do, that AI can't do. And I'm like, okay, like what? It's like, well, the machines, you know, the procedures, you know, the companies, you know, the AI, you know, all this, you know, what it can solve problems, but what humans can do is create problems. Like AI can't do that.
Right.
Because it doesn't want anything, right? So our problems come to the fact that we want something, and no matter how good things are, we still want more. And that's what a problem is, you know, kind of an operational definition, or at least one version of a problem is the difference between where you are and where you want to be. You know, that's a problem. And we create problems. So yes, the AI or whatever can help us solve them, but it won't come up with its own problems because it doesn't want anything. So, you know, and that's funny too, because you think about it, like that's a core of a lot of philosophies and religion. You know, if you look at Buddhism, the reason that you're having a hard day is because you want something. You got desire that's fucking up your life.
Yep.
But at the same time, like maybe it's not fucking up your life. Maybe what it's giving you is something to do.
You're just bored. Go outside and play.
Yeah. Boredom could be a problem because you don't want to be bored. So the fact that you want to be something other than bored is a problem. And I have, you know, some Zen master friends, which I think is ridiculous. I mean, even to say that out loud sounds like just stupid. I mean, they're really great people, and I really respect them. But I like to mess with them from time to time. Like, I always like to be late because, you know, with the Zen master, if they say you're late, it's like, well, there is no time. I mean, right? But the other thing I like to do, you know, especially with one of my really good friends, is just to say, you know, look, the fact that you want to be a Zen master is kind of like against the whole point, right? Like, the fact that you're not completely content with where you are, that you're doing all this study and that you're doing all this meditation is somewhat hypocritical, right? Don't you think? Or if you call yourself a Zen master as a way to kind of, you know, reinforce your identity being separate from the rest of the world, isn't that kind of, that's not very Zen. And he's, you know, martial artist too. So if he throws a punch at me, I'm like, that wasn't a very Zen punch, man. Like, but we're, you know, it's just,
I love how you think and deconstruct things.
It's just because, you know, we struggle with the same stuff. You know, we all have the same problems, which is we don't have good enough problems.
Yeah, I think so.
We have a good problem, you know, and when we're, you know, when we're kind of concluding with that event, it was, look, the best problem you can work on as a human being is trying to figure out how to be a better human being. that's a serious problem.
Yeah.
It's hard. Like, what does that even mean? Like, what does it mean to be a good human? Maybe we could save that for part two.
Let's do it.
Because I have to think about it. Like, I don't even have a guess.
I'll make a note and we can do some homework and then talk about that. So, Sean, where can people find you if they want to make you lucky and hire you as a professional two or more times in a row? Where could people track you down?
Well, probably the easiest way, people can just email me or okay. They can do, you know, Twitter or whatever.
Okay.
But if it's Sean P. Kearney at pretty much anything. So it could be Sean P. Kearney at Outlook, at Gmail, okay. At Twitter, you know, I'm on LinkedIn. I actually use LinkedIn a lot because what I like about LinkedIn, and I don't use Facebook. I hate Facebook. I'm okay with anybody who uses it. I just don't use it because for me, my... I feel bad about if I use it. Like if I monitor my own state of mind, it deteriorates rapidly as I scroll through the Facebook timeline. If I'm really honest about why, it's because I see all these people who I barely know, who I have to admit I really don't care about. But then I feel bad that I don't care about them. I'm like, oh, there's my aunt that I haven't seen in 20 years and I haven't talked to either. And she's out doing something fun and she's really excited about it. And I don't give a shit. And now I feel bad about myself that I don't care. Or, oh, look, this friend of mine I went to high school with just had her third baby. I'm like, I don't care. Like, I don't even care what her baby looks like because I'm never going to see the baby. And then I think, well, what the fuck is wrong with me? And that's like 3-4 minutes in. And I'm like, I can't. I just got to stop. But what I liked about LinkedIn is it's conversations about topics as opposed to just people.
Yeah.
Because I do care about people. And although you may not think that after this conversation. But, you know, what I like about people is that working on stuff together. Like if there's a connection, it's going to be we have it over something. As opposed to we're just relatives or we just like yeah. this idea of friends of convenience. God, that like kills me, man. Like I don't want to be somebody's friend of convenience and I certainly don't want to have any friends of convenience. And I've been through that too many times, you know, with like work colleagues that you think you're like really great friends, but as soon as you leave, they never talk to you again because you're not around and it's not convenient to talk anymore. Where you don't have the same point of reference, you know, so you're not working on the same problem anymore. But, yeah, I mean, I think, you know, just got LinkedIn.
Well said, my friend. Thanks for an awesome part one. Appreciate it.
Thanks, man. I appreciate it.